Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Well, as it often happens, my guest and I have spent a few minutes already chit-chatting a little bit about her new book and some of our experiences and what we hope to cover in this conversation. So, Kelly, I'm hoping that what we record is even better than what we just did before we hit record. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here in conversation with you and tease out a little bit more things, common experiences we have and new conversations that we can forge together.
Yes. So we are recording this in December. We are in the midst of Advent right now. And you have written an incredible book called The First Advent in Palestine, Reversals, Resistance, and the Ongoing Complexity of Hope. And Kelly, I just want to say, first of all, that yes, the book itself is stunning, but, and I know everyone can't see this, it's not fair. I'll put a link in the show notes, but the cover art to this book is stunning. I think that it might be kind of a good place for us to start. Like when people pick this book up and they see this beautiful artwork on the cover, what are they witnessing even in the cover art of this book?
Well, the cover art was so important to me. If you think about the title, there's a lot of heavy lifting that each of those words are doing, right? Advent, Palestine, resistance, complexity of hope. But what I knew was that the image on the cover was going to be what would, I hope, would pull people in. And it was important to me that that be art by a Palestinian artist. And so this image is called The Flight into Egypt, and it is by the iconic artist known to be the artist of resistance in Palestine. His name is Sliman Mansour. And so he gave us permission to use this art, which I'm so grateful. But in it, he is showing, you know, a very Palestinian picture of a mother and her child, right? Which Jesus and Mary, and the backdrop, very indicative of Palestine, and the empty sack of flour across her lap. It's, if you look close, you can see that it says UN relief, because man, we get a bag of flour and sometimes that's all we get. And so to hear him talk about this artwork and then allow us to use it for the cover of the book just meant so much to me. And I hope that it does pull people into the reality that, you know, Palestinian stories are part of the first Palestine and, you know, Advent in Palestine today. I mean, the first Advent and Advent today in Palestine. So his work does a lot of goodness in getting us in that direction, I think.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I had just like almost forgotten that I wanted to bring that up first thing, because it's stunning. And yeah, the UN relief there is, there's so much story there, right? There's so much connection between what's happening now and what happened then. And I think, you know, part of the connection that I remember, you know, one of the first times when I was like, oh snap, Jesus was a refugee, right? Like, right. It was one of these like crazy, you know, crazy moments. And I'd love to, you know, you get your take on that for sure. But, you know, you really start off, one of the things I appreciate so much about how you started this book was setting the scene for the first Advent. You know, you name what many, I think, American evangelical Protestants would say, yeah, this is the story I heard too, which is that God was silent. Mm-hmm. Right. There's this intertestamental period where God was silent and then boom, and then Jesus comes and he's the light, and, you know, and it feels very Sunday school, and it feels, you know, kind of these things. And you really, I appreciated so much how you intentionally took the time at the beginning of the book to set up, just because this didn't make our canon doesn't actually mean historically that there was a period of what we might have known as silence there, that Jesus stepped into. He was born into a very, very specific political environment inside of Roman occupied Palestine. So can you tell us about that history a little bit for those of us who may not be as familiar? And then, you know, like, why is that important for you, writing a devotional, a book, and not a devotional book on Advent? Like, why is that part important to you?
Well, let's be very candid. This is not a devotional book.
That's right. That's correct.
Anybody expects a devotional book for Advent, this is not it. It's an exploration of those beautiful Advent narratives that we
do have devotionals. We'll link to those. That's what I was thinking of. But this is definitely not it. That's correct.
Right. I never want people to feel like I have misled them in what I am offering. So these are explorations of the Advent texts that were gifted by Luke and Matthew. But I am a big context girl. I have always believed in the deep importance of knowing the context of a part of scripture, if we're going to share it for devotion or for a sermon, or even for our own meditation on scripture. It's so important to know this didn't just come from nowhere. It's connected to something. And so it was in that process of trying to see what is the connective tissue to these Advent stories, because I was raised to believe, you know, we have God speaking to the prophet Malachi, and then we have, right, nothing for those 400 years until the gospel writers start telling us what was going to be happening in the land. And of course, I think we can look back and say, well, of course we knew that time still happened, but there is something that when there is no testimony, there's no testament to it between the page of what we call the Old Testament and the New Testament, it's easy to sort of think, well, nothing significant happened. Even if we could look back and say, oh, well, wait a minute, that can't be true. But if it's not there, we are kind of conditioned to believe nothing that you need to know, nothing that mattered, nothing that shaped this story mattered. Otherwise, we would have had it there. And of course, our Catholic brothers and sisters do include the Apocrypha in their version of the Bible, which is how I found it, because I have some Catholic roots. And in hunting around and finding my mother's Catholic Jerusalem Bible, it's like, wait a minute, there's some things in the middle here, which is where I discovered the story of the Maccabees. And yet another time when the Jewish people were under occupation, this time by the Seleucid Empire, and their temple had been destroyed, and there was religious persecution and heavy taxation and violent uprisings, and you know, with the Seleucid military. And you know, I think for me what cracked open was this is what predates the arrival of God, right? Jesus's birth. What was happening on the ground was 400 years of trauma, of both military and economic exploitation, of land loss and enslavement and just loss. And if anybody got to be silent, it was only God, because on the ground, there would have been such loud lament, cries of pain and mourning the losses that happened under these successive empires. And so I think it's important to recognize that this is what predates our Advent stories. And maybe to put it another way, that when we recognize, you know, now we, I think, have more what I would call trauma-informed theology. We are starting to understand what trauma is and how it affects our human bodies, how it affects our psychology and how we respond to the stimuli around us. And we are starting to understand generational trauma. Well, now I read back into these texts and think, in the body of the Jewish people, there was generational trauma. And it would have shaped their bodies, their ways of thinking and reacting. It would have shaped their culture. And so when Jesus is born into a story and literally born into human skin, Jesus was born into a family that was victim of generational trauma. Jesus is not exempt from the experience of generational trauma and the lived experience of trauma that he would undergo in his human journey. I think that is actually a very important thing to understand about the incarnation. So I think context for the Advent stories, it's important to know about Jewish suffering. But I also think it starts us thinking differently about even what incarnation means. This is in the body of Jesus, and therefore in the body of God.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think this time of year, I get a little teary, a little more easily than you know, I do in other times of the year, other meditations. But this is, you know, I just like, this makes the magnificent make more sense, right? When we think about it in this way, that it wasn't, you know, a poem that she had memorized or something like this, right? But this is her cry of understanding, I think, at least at that first level of what this could mean for her people, you know, what this could mean for them.
Yes, the Magnificat rings different when we factor in the reality of the trauma that Mary, as a member of this community, would have experienced. And when we understand her region in particular, right, Galilee was what I call a restive region. There was always things happening up in the Galilee region. There was military incursions from the Roman Empire because of all of it, because there was so much resistance and banditry and so many things happening that not unlike the West Bank now, you see so much activity and it shapes you, right? It shapes you into a kind of person to see the injustices every day, to see your uncles being humiliated, to see your cousins going out on some of these protests, to maybe see other things, because the soldiers were known for coming in pretty hard on the women. This should not be uncommon for us to know, but often war is really particularly difficult for women. And the Roman Empire was known for raping women as a way to humiliate and make their control so visceral. Mary would have known that. She would have seen it happen in her community because it was so prevalent in the Galilee region at the time. And so I think when she sings that song, she is singing from a very real place of, I know what this feels like, and I am being redeemed in real time. And that's how I know that God will, in fact, redeem others. So is her song prophetic? Sure. But I think the more important thing is she's telling us what is happening in her body and in her story in real time. This is happening to me, that I am the lowly, humiliated one that is being lifted up. That's how I know that God will do it for others.
That's right.
Right? She, you know, it's from her own experience. And that song to me just vibrates with a different intensity and liberative power when you factor that in.
Yeah. Sometimes I like to say that that the prophetic is just saying what is, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's exactly what you just said. Mary is saying what is.
Exactly. I think that's a perfect way to say it.
So you mentioned it, Kelly, that, you know, we've got context for the first Advent. Before we started recording, I mentioned that a friend of mine had shared a video with me that you had actually also shared on your social media about Bethlehem now, today, inside the West Bank and what that looks like specifically for Palestinian Christians inside of Bethlehem and the West Bank now. But I want to go back to where you started to go, because there's historical context of trauma and then what we know, but I'll just say from my experience, what many American Christians are not super aware of is the traumatic experiences of Palestinians now and their families and communities and having lived where they live for some of them hundreds, if not a thousand years or more. Mm-hmm. But especially over the last, almost 100 years as things have shifted dramatically in the Middle East. So you share some stories of Palestinians that you know in the book, but without going there just yet, why is it important that we understand this current context and the current conflict? Why would that be important to us as we think about Advent, as we meditate on the incarnation? Why does that matter to us in our context now?
Well, I'll start with a little bit of my own story in terms of why Palestinians are important in my own story. And maybe we'll get to where you want to go with a little direction, maybe. But I grew up in both Catholic and predominantly evangelical spaces. I grew up in a season, at least the 80s and 90s, where there was such fervor around the Holy Land. And it was a big deal, if you could go to the Holy Land and visit the places where Jesus walked. And I heard so often really eloquent testimony of times spent in the Holy Land and meeting Jewish men and women in the Holy Land and, especially in Jerusalem, et cetera. But it wasn't until after college I picked up a book. It was right when the Intifada, I now know, it was when the first Intifada happened, the first uprising of Palestinians in the West Bank. And so it was hitting the news. And all I knew is that something was roiling in the Middle East. And as, somebody who just graduated from college, I'm like, well, I'll pick up a book on that. I'll read one book and I'll understand everything happening in the Middle East. How naive I was. But I picked up a book and it was the first time, and this book was, it was a New York Times bestseller, was not written by a Christian person. And this person was telling me that there was another people group in the Holy Land. I knew about the Jewish people. And I probably at some level knew that there were also some variety of Christians there. But I never knew that there were Palestinian people who had equally deep roots in the place, in that same land that we call holy. That blew my mind. And I almost felt like, what kind of a Christian am I that I didn't know this? But now I can look back and say, well, nobody told me. Mm-hmm. It was like this little secret. Nobody told you that they were there. And now I know that when people would go to the Holy Land, they didn't go to the places where our Palestinian brothers and sisters live. And so, I think the other thing is that when people do find out that there are Palestinians, so many of them are Muslim, but they don't even realize that actually there are Christian Palestinians. These are our brothers and sisters in even a deeper way, not only our human brothers and sisters, but we share the same faith tradition. And they are there and they are safeguarding our holy sites and they are right. So I think for me, this is where it began, the recognition like, oh, now that I have seen them, I can't unsee. And so for the next set of, 30 years, I've been reading books out of the region from both Jewish and Messianic Jewish and Palestinian and Muslim. I'm reading from all over because I just want to learn and have traveled there multiple times and now have some very dear Palestinian friends. And to me, it's like, oh, understanding their story is part of understanding the story of this place that we call holy. It is part of understanding the texture of the world of Jesus. But I also think that now there is this different dynamic because our Palestinian friends are now living under times that are quite fraught. And I think we need to explore that now imperial dynamics. It used to be Rome pressing upon the Jewish people. I think a case could be made that now it is the Israeli state and largely empowered by the West, including our own country, the United States. They are the oppressive force that our Palestinian friends are living under and struggling under. And I think that calls upon a lot of really hard work to understand the history, which is quite complex, to maybe investigate our own complicity. Where are our blind spots? What do we need to learn? Part of my journeying there has been to continue to learn by putting myself in the world of my friends and letting that shape me and challenge me. But my guess is there are other people who similarly are faithful Christians, faithful students of scripture, and may not even know, oh, there are Christian Palestinians. There are a whole other group of people that also are part of this story. And so my hope was that maybe if I could put some of that in this book, it would help people not only see the power dynamics and ask some of those questions, but even just saying, oh, alongside our Jewish and Messianic brothers and sisters and Christians, there are also Palestinians. And so let's see them. I mean, the shepherds were kind of the unseen people in the Advent stories, right? They were the essential workers that, you know, you needed them, but you didn't want to see them. And I sometimes think that, you know, the Palestinians are treated that way. They're not fully seen, but they're there and they are stewards of our holy sites. And they are fighting for justice in their own communities.
Yeah, no, it's right. It's rich and it's good. I loved that section where you compared the shepherds to essential workers, calling Bethlehem, I think, like the house of meat, right? This is
it was the meatpacking industry.
That's right. It's the meatpacking industry. Yeah.
Jerusalem, the temple had to get their meat from somewhere.
That's exactly right.
They got it from Bethlehem, which is not very far away.
It's a hop, skip, and a jump, you know, it's just right there.
Just cross a checkpoint and you're there.
But, you know, I think that I'm going to interject just a little bit because I really appreciate you giving us that background and that context, and especially from, you know, where you were coming from. I will say my story is similar, but it's later. You know, I started traveling to Israel during the Second Intifada at the beginning of the 2000s. So 2003 was my first trip. But last month was my first time to cross a checkpoint. So I've been to the Holy Land 8 times and 1 time, only have I spent time in Palestine, and I am still processing that trip. And so I won't process completely out loud with you here, you know, other than to say that I'm incredibly grateful for what you've done in this book. But I would say my experience has a lot of similarities. And I think it's good that you and I can talk through this a little bit and kind of have kind of found each other in our similarities and our stories, because it makes me say, you know, like if there's two, there's more, right? If there's two of us who have this similar story, there's more, right? And this is not an uncommon thing for American Christians, you know, especially. Yeah, you know, I hear this all the time. Like, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. It's a pilgrimage, you know, thing. And then it crushes parts of my heart to think that for people for whom it is a once in a lifetime opportunity, they might miss the chance to get to engage with so many people who are still a very vital part of the land and of the Christian faith and story. And that is the Palestinians who live, you know, many of them on the other side of the wall, you know, where Bethlehem exists today. Mm-hmm. And so I do think as Christians, as we explore you know, the biblical aspects of the story that you bring forward, the context there, the questions that we could ask about what were Mary's experiences, what were her family's experiences, what did this look like for Jesus to be born into this political environment. I think it's entirely appropriate that we also ask some of those same questions about our contemporary context today, you know, because, you know, letting our hearts break for what Jesus was born into, we gives us a bridge to help us understand and form compassion for what's happening now in Palestine. And I think it's just vital that we do that as Christians. I think it's just vital that we do that.
If we recognize it in the text, and I hope that that's part of what my excavation work was if you can see it here, then you should be able to turn on the news and recognize it. And that may provoke a lot of soul searching on our part. But Jesus is always telling us, right, to repent, to rethink. Repentance is about rethinking, recalibrating what you think you know. And so I think, you know, if we can look at scripture well and see the dynamics, political, economic, socio-political, I mean, they're all there. If we can see that, then we can actually look at the news and say, oh, I see some things and I might have to rethink, but this is the invitation. And I'm so grateful this is where the Spirit guides us in that process, I believe.
So. Yeah. I mean, one of the places that I found to be really interesting as far as the, you know, your exploration of the biblical text was concerned is the talk about justice. You know, we kind of, I don't know, many of us kind of have this thought, and you name it, of like, this is about the law, or this is about, you know, these kinds of things, right? We can kind of, I don't know, sometimes I get excited. I kind of think this is what we bang our fists about, you know, is this kind of thing. But you're like, yeah, and what about the money, right? Like, you talk a lot about the economic justice. And again, then these things from the text just start coming out, right? Like, we know Mary and Joseph, when they went to the temple, had to sacrifice birds.
Yep.
They were poor people in a poor region, in a poor land. Mm-hmm. And Jesus grew up in this house. Like, can you talk about that a little bit? Because I do. I love this exploration of this incarnation and Advent. We're like, well, let's talk about Jesus being here in the body. This is what it looked like. He was not feasting like a king every night at his dinner table. This is not what it looked like.
And this is where I think, you know, my husband is from Burundi, which is a small country, landlocked country in East Africa. And they always come in near the bottom of the UN's list of underdeveloped countries. They're usually in the bottom five in terms of being there. And we do development work. That's kind of our day job. And, but my husband grew up on less than a dollar a day. So when we talk about that, less than a dollar a day, it's like, that was his lived experience. And, you know, it was really helpful to hear, because what I know that means is there are meals you don't have. And the meals that you do get are not full of nutrient rich foods. It's so many people in countries in like this, and Palestine now is a lot like this, and Palestine then was absolutely like this. So to grow up poor, as most people did, as Joseph and Mary and Jesus would have grown up this way, yes, it means you lacked resources, but it also meant like you were most likely malnourished, which does things to your body and our cognitive function. It shapes society in a certain way to grow up in a kind of a world that is dealing with such deep economic stress. I mean, there's lots of studies now about how extreme poverty is a driver of trauma. So like in our work, we have trauma therapists that work in our most impoverished communities, because poverty, like the violence that we associate with militarism, actually similar dynamics, you know, when you are being exploited economically, it is also traumatic, and it shapes a society a certain way. This would have been the bodily experience of Jesus, to grow up you know, of course, we will hear the story from Matthew that, you know, he was a political target of Herod's, and that's why they became political refugees to Egypt for a while. And even when they returned, they couldn't go back to Bethlehem, where they probably, where they had right family connection and probably a plot, according to Matthew. They had to go up and around to Nazareth. They were basically internally displaced. Like, this is all in the body of Jesus. And I think how we never hear in the story, in the Gospels, we don't hear that adult Jesus ever returned to Bethlehem. He went down to Bethany. He went to places around. And I wonder if there isn't some purpose, like, did Jesus experience survivor's guilt? He got out of Bethlehem before Herod, right? And the slaughter of the innocents, where he would have lost family members like his, like Zechariah, right? And I think the, you know, when you think about the humanity of Jesus, he comes into this traumatized, you know, his DNA already has that in his human DNA. And then his lived experience, you know, the lack of the maybe malnourished, most likely malnourishment, the lack of education, the survivor's guilt, the, like all of these things, like Jesus entered into the most, probably what most humans experience as normative. You and I are probably among those privileged, a small percentage of privileged people who don't know this kind of trauma, this kind of human experience. But I have learned that most people live a life that is shaped by war, economic duress, these kinds of, you know, malnourishment, et cetera. And what, you know, when we talk about incarnation, God came into what probably was the most ubiquitous human experience to enter into deep solidarity with humanity. That's what Jesus did. And that's what we see if we can pull apart the threads of the story and really look and say, wow, God understands what it is to really be human at its most difficult, at its most basic. And that now, like, as I say, lives in the body of God. That's to me what incarnation is. It's how deeply God has experienced the world as most people experience it.
Yeah, Kelly, and as you're talking, I think how right it is for us to be curious and ask those questions. You know, like I wonder, maybe he did have survivor's guilt, you know? We don't. You're right. And not that I can think of, we don't see him go back to Bethlehem. What is, you know, what does that mean? This was the place where his dad was from, right? You know, so like what is it about that? You know, just to begin to ask those questions, to allow ourselves to be curious, you know, and just to say, as you mentioned, like we're learning more about trauma studies now. And, you know, in fact, I'm taking a class, the final that I'm going to write as soon as we hang up here, as I'm going to finish, is on a Theologies of Exile class, where we take a lot of time looking at the prophets, and especially Ezekiel and Jeremiah. Now we're in the Torah right now. But just through the lens of trauma, you know, what did this look like? And I think a lot of times with maybe the history of the exile, but certainly with the Gospels as well, for those of us who have grown up around those stories, they just become really common. You know, the language becomes common. You know, we can, you know, kind of tell these stories with our eyes closed. You know, the language becomes very, very familiar, right? Yeah. And it breaks my heart when I'm reading through the prophets now, mm-hmm. and doing close readings and trying to go, what did this actually mean? You know, like, What if Jeremiah isn't just, you know, entirely poetic in what he's saying, right? What if people are experiencing things like this? Then what did that look like? Or okay, let's pretend it is poetic. What was going on that made those words so meaningful for the community and for the population, right? And as we look at the gospel stories, I think that to ask ourselves some of those similar questions, even for text that is so familiar, can really deepen our, our love, our affection for Jesus, for sure, but our understanding of what that really meant
Yes.
That he would come in incarnate into a body like this, into experiences yes. like this, you know?
And I think seeing, you know, like you said, as you were talking about the ways we become familiar with texts, right? We have these stones with sharp edges, but over time we've polished them down to these rounded pebbles that we so cavalierly hold and toss in our hands. And yet they were sharp. They were meant to be sharp. They were forged in pain, right? That we are so out of touch with, that has been sanitized or domesticated or just softened over with our familiarity. And I definitely see that in the gospel stories. Like now I see what, you know, like when you think of poker, right? Somebody has a tell. And like now I'm like, oh, the tells are all throughout these stories that Matthew and Luke are giving us. But boy, until I revisited them over the last set of years, I hadn't seen them. And I'm like, gosh, I'm a student of scripture. I'm a faithful Christian. And I missed it. But Luke intended that you would definitely see one of the big features of his story is the economy is a huge, huge character right alongside Mary and Joseph and Gabriel and the shepherds. You're meant to see. I mean, he talks about that darn census that they had to go register like five times. He mentioned, meaning you're supposed to pick up on this. There's a tax hike coming for people who are already barely making it. Joseph wasn't just traveling south, worried about his wife who was pregnant. He was also probably worried about like, right, things are going to get worse. And how are we going to economically make this work for us? Like we are meant to see the economy as such an integral part of Luke's story. But man, have I missed it for all those years. And coming back to it in the last set of years has allowed me to go, oh, wow, now I can't not see it, right? Now it's there. And seeing these stories afresh, now every time I encounter a gospel story, like further on, it's like, oh, Jesus having conversations with Roman functionaries when he most likely was a victim of, you know, right? He was traumatized by a lot of Romans in his childhood. He might have lost a parent due to a Roman invasion. He lost his uncle Zechariah with what happened down in Bethlehem. Like he would have had in his own body this, my life is shaped by these people. And then you see how he is magnanimous and how he points out things, but also invites them. And I'm like, Jesus is much more stunning when you factor in what would have been in his human self, in his human experience, and that humanness to react. It's like Jesus is even more, to me, he is even more miraculous in his utter humanity, you know?
That's right. And, you know, I've had this conversation a couple of different times, but it keeps coming up. And I think it's because it's stunning to me too. And it's important, I think, for us as Christians that, you know, sometimes we have this view of Jesus as if he was only divine, you know, it was because we have this, the dualism that exists and some of the, you know, things that we take with us in our faith that really, I don't know, N.T. Yes. Wright would say aren't exactly biblical, we're like, oh, but it was just a show, you know, it was like just a shell, it's just a body. And he was like, really just like this God inside of this like shell of a skin, you know, it's like, but really, no, like he really was, as we're talking about, fully, yes. fully human and fully divine. And so it's not that he just snapped his fingers, you know, like the chick on Bewitched and was like, okay, I'm going to talk to these Romans and be like totally fine about it now. You know, like it was in him, mm-hmm. in his whole self, you know, yes. in a way that we can't fathom. I understand. But I think we do ourselves a disservice, our faith a disservice, when we neglect to, I don't know, to be curious, to use that word again, when we neglect to be curious about Jesus' humanity in that way.
And I wonder, I mean, for me, I don't know if this is your experience, but I grew up where when incarnation was talked about, I mean, yes, sometimes, yes, the incarnation happened at the Christmas story, but the deeper conversations about incarnation were always connected to atonement. So, right, it was more about, yeah, he had to be born.
That's right. Yep.
into human, you know, so, okay, yes, at Christmas, so that then we could really talk about the big deal, which was what happened during Holy Week.
That's right.
That's where, so much of my understanding about incarnation has been shaped from crucifixion, right? From Holy Week and atonement thinking. And I think this has been such a revelation for me to actually look at incarnation from Advent instead of atonement. And I'm like, wow, it changes everything for me.
Yeah.
And how humanity becomes the place, right, that God works. Even in Mary's story, right, in her humanity, God enters in and well, that's a whole nother story. But I think that has been one of the fundamental things for me is I see the incarnation so differently now because of the Advent stories. And I think it's a healthy corrective. To me, it makes Jesus so much more relatable. Maybe not to me as an upper class, you know, American white passing person, but I think for so many people in the world over, this picture of Jesus is like, yeah, oh, he is like us in every way, and has suffered what we have suffered, and knows our pain. It makes Jesus more relatable, I think, to think. Maybe he too struggled with survivor's guilt. Maybe he too knew what it was like to be, like to have hunger pangs from not eating. Like, wow. And I think for a whole group of people, this makes Jesus a say, you know, yes, he knows us and therefore knows how to save us. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I would like for you to share, if you would, another kind of one of your tells. Mm-hmm. And it can be from the book or not from the book, but, you know, we talked a little bit about the economy. We talked a little bit about the resistance in the Galilee region, a little bit about the unseenness. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, yes, of the shepherds, but of others in the story as mm-hmm. well. When you think about going through the Gospels now, what are some of those things what's at least one of those things that you thought, I can't believe I didn't see that.
Well, I think when you recognize that, first of all, I believe, and if you read the book, you'll see how I get there theologically, but I do believe that Joseph most likely perished in some Roman incursions up in Sepphoris when Jesus was quite young. And so we think, you know, Jesus having lost his father at a young age to the empire. Again, I think that deeply shapes the way you see him deal with any Roman soldier, any Roman functionary throughout the story. Or those who are losing, you know, any other fathers he's dealing with. I sometimes wonder what was the relationship between him and John the Baptist really? You know, John the Baptist is like, my dad died protecting me in Bethlehem, you know, right outside of Bethlehem. But you got advance notice and got to leave and go to Egypt. I mean, don't you think there might have been a little, even if they loved each other, a little awkwardness or a little work that they had to do? I mean, their humanness around their fathers and losing their fathers, both of them losing them to the empire in one way or another. I think of Mary being somebody who would have been aware of brutality against women, maybe herself a victim of it. We don't know. I think there is a valid reading of the story that Mary is as likely to have been a victim as not. And, you know, what would it, when I think about Mary's possible experience, or at least her deep understanding of what it is to be the precarity of being a woman in that time, and the stigma that she would have had raising Jesus on her own. Well, then you watch the way that Jesus deals with women. And I just think there was so much there that he would have seen in his own mother's story, seen in his aunties and cousins, and would have shaped how he saw and interacted with women with a different kind of knowing, a different kind of tenderness. And the times when he stood up for, I'm not going to condemn you. And none of these guys can either, right? That he had a different perspective. I don't know. I just thought there's hardly a story that I've come to since I've done this that I don't say, oh, wow, when you understand where the story started, where Jesus started, where his natal family started, it's deeper, it's richer, it's more challenging sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's definitely more challenging. And I think that, you know, for what it is, for everything that's wonderful and fun and beautiful, sometimes the Christmas culture that we have here in the States make things like this more challenging, right? Mm-hmm. My husband sometimes refers to me as a Debbie Downer, right? Like, you know, Kelly's with me. You can't see that. She raised her hand. I'm gonna say she's joined me. Yes. She joined me. But you know, because this is heavy, right? Yes. To think about these kinds of things. It's heavy to meditate on them. It's mm-hmm. heavy, when we think about trying to figure out how to hold intention, the joy of a new baby and the hardship that can bring when everything else is well in the world or in your world, you know, to imagine, you know, just let our theological imaginations go, you know, mm-hmm. for a few minutes or for a few hours or, you know, to sit yes. and read this work. It is challenging. It really is, because the complexity that it brings to our faith is hard to hold.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But isn't it also, I mean, for me, it's challenging, but it's also deeply comforting.
Yes.
Because somehow I read this and I feel like, oh, but this makes so much more sense. This feels so much more true. And that if this is what the writers, Luke and Matthew, were experiencing and wanted to share with us about what most likely was happening, like, this feels like the more honest understanding of what it is to be human, what the world often looks like, because there have been so many empires since, and so many people who have suffered, whether it was death or enslavement or sexual abuse or land loss. Like, when I read it that way, I feel like finally somebody's being honest about what this human experience is and where God enters into it. Not neat and tidy. There is the ongoing complexity of hope. It's there, but it is, we have to look at the hard stuff in order to really get to hope. But then it's more solid. But there's a deep comfort for me. Like, I'm doing this and I remember my editor was like, this is pretty intense. Like, we need to leave people with some hope. And I'm like, oh, but honesty is so comforting and kind of the runway to hope for me.
Absolutely. And well, and you know, I think about as you were talking about in the empires continue, right? And I think like Luke 2 is kind of the quintessential, you know, if somebody's going to read something on Christmas morning while their kids are trying to tear at the presents, it's probably going to be Luke 2. But if we just flip a couple of pages, might be my favorite chapter in Luke, which is Luke 4. And you mention, or you allude to it near the beginning of the book. This is where Jesus almost gets thrown off a cliff, right? Yeah. But he almost gets thrown off a cliff in the wake of reading from the scroll of Isaiah that...
Those beautiful Jubilee texts.
Those beautiful Jubilee texts. But
they're also sharp.
They are sharp. And, you know, then, I mean, I preached on this a couple of weeks ago and I come back to John the Baptist, who is one of my absolute favorites, you know, but then Jesus again quotes from Isaiah, right? And this felt sharp to John in prison, waiting to be beheaded, right? I've come to do all of these things. And guess what, my friend? None of this is going to happen for you, right? Mm-hmm. And this is hard, right? This is really, really hard. But this is the hope of the gospel, though. this is what I think we, you know, I would say in my experience and my upbringing, you know, I don't think I'm the only one who kind of missed it. But there is a holistic gospel that Jesus is preaching with his whole body.
Yes.
with his whole body, right? This isn't about, you know, the hope isn't, well, you get to join me in heaven when you die. Like, there is hope for us in the world today, in our living today. There is hope
for
us.
It is a hard-born hope.
Oh.
It is a hard-born hope. I mean, those Jubilee texts, I mean, they are good news for the poor.
Yeah.
They are hard news for the rest of us.
That's right. That's right.
Right. That's the connection I made, is I think the Advent stories are good news for the poor. And they are hard news for those of us who have something to lose, who have something we have to reconsider, who have something that we have been complicit in. Man, these stories should make us tremble a bit. That's what they're meant to do for people who are in our position. But man, yes. Good news, like my husband's family, he's like, hearing that your debts have been forgiven, there would have been nothing more exciting to his father than hearing that. His father was a pastor and a church planter for 45 years, known countrywide for the work he did spreading the gospel and growing churches. And the best news would have been, Andre Nikundeha, your debts are forgiven. And my dad would have had to struggle with the other side, which is, you have some things to give back. You have some land that isn't yours to keep. You have some deep thinking about how the economy works that you need to rethink to stay in this Jubilee campaign, right? But Advent gives us some similar notes, I think.
That's right. All right, Kelly, now I'm getting fired up.
I cannot talk about Jubilee texts and not get fired up and cry simultaneously.
I'm hearing you. And now I'm fired up, but I'm gonna I want to ask you to wrap us up, Kelly. This conversation has just been food for my soul, and so I'm so appreciative. It's hard in this time of year. Sometimes I get wrapped up in the wrong things, just to be truthful. And they're not always wrong, you know. But it's like I want to take the time. I want to meditate on the miracle of the incarnation, and not just that this teenage woman was pregnant with the Messiah, but what that meant as he was born into that situation and lived into that situation, his life of hope, what that meant for them and what it means for us. So Kelly, I'm just going to ask you to wrap us up. What question didn't I ask? Where didn't I go? Or what meditation might you have for us as we move closer to the celebration of Christmas in this season?
Well, I think there's one scene that I wished if I could challenge, I wish translators would have done a better job interpreting what Luke was trying to tell us about what that initial Christmas Eve looked like. Because I grew up believing that it was a very solitary, very lonely, in a sense, experience of Joseph and Mary not being able to find lodging, kind of on the outskirts, maybe finding a cave. If you've ever been to Bethlehem, they take you to Shepherd's Field, where there's some little cave that maybe Jesus was born in, out there on the outskirts. Thank God some shepherds came by and some angels, you know, had some songs to sing, but it was a very lonely scene. And I actually don't think that that's what Luke intended to describe. And I think so much has been done with that little word in, that there was no room in the inn. And we translators, like I said, have made this worse, but in our Americanness, we hear an inn and we think of a motel. There was no room in the motel and there were no room in any of the other motels. And so they end up on the outskirts. But that's not the understanding where I think we're meant to get. Joseph was coming to his family home. This is his extended family. They may not have been his intimate family, but they were his extended family. If you know anything about the Abrahamic cultures, it's a big deal. You would have been welcomed. There would have been room for you in the family compound. Now, I know something about compounds from living in Burundi, where there's a compound where there's a nice big wall or hedge or something. And inside there's a house with a few private rooms. There are some other covered spaces. there's the area where the livestock is that's still in the compound. There's some quarters out back where maybe some of your workers live. And actually, this tracks with what it looked like in ancient Palestine. There would have been a family compound. And so there wasn't room in the inn. And the better translation would be in a private room. There wasn't a private room where Mary could have shut the door and, you know, had a moment. But they would have been welcomed into the family compound with all of Joseph's family. And they would have been part of the family meals, and they would have been surrounded and had a place, not a private space, not an inn, but maybe out by the livestock, but still within the boundaries of the family compound, still within the welcome of the family. And I imagine, in my mind, I see, you know, all the women are busy making dinner. They're cutting up, you know, they're pitting the olives and cutting up cucumbers and tearing the fresh mint leaves and putting everything there. And Mary's water breaks. And all of those women, you know, wash their hands and functionally become midwives. And she is surrounded by family. And Joseph is waiting with family to get word about, you know, the safe birth of their son. And I just think we have been given a very lonely Christmas Eve. But I actually imagine they were surrounded by family that loved them and cared for them and celebrated the birth of this baby. And that the shepherds got to come into the compound and share in the party. But that they were not alone. And even that, like I said, gives me comfort that Mary was surrounded by new aunties and cousins. And I would hope that that might be more of the picture we have, that even though we have these little creches around our house or under our Christmas tree that just show Joseph and Mary and Jesus, imagine the family that loved them and welcomed them and surrounded them and helped usher this little life into the world, like you said, in the midst of all that was terrible about the empire, right? The pushback that we still have each other. You cannot beat out of us the hospitality and the joy that we have in each other. Even Herod can't do that. Even Caesar can't do that. You raise our taxes, but you can't deprive us of our humanity and the ability to be together. So maybe that would give us a different picture on Christmas Eve.
That was one of my favorite parts, Kelly. I loved it. Thank you so much. Thank you. Oh, thank you for this conversation. Thank you for the book. Thank you for that fresh. It is for me a fresh meditation as we move in to Christmas Eve and Christmas, and the thought of Jesus and his parents being surrounded by family brings me so much joy. Again, this is Kelly Nicondeja, writer of The First Advent in Palestine, Reversals, Resistance, and the Ongoing Complexity of Hope. I'll link this on the show notes so that everyone can know where they can find it. This will air just about a week before Christmas, but I would encourage everyone that if the shipping makes it impossible for you to get your hands on before Christmas morning, read it anyway. Read it after. Read it. Keep it for next year. This, as Kelly and I have talked and as she has shared, this just helps us get a little bit more of a grasp on the complexity of our faith and who we serve as our Savior. So thanks for being with us, Kelly.
It was a joy to be with you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.